Yeah, you think it's better to... I'm recording for OCHS, for the center, and then would you like to click on it, or...
I can, it's also
I'm
possible.
I'm going to be up there.
Oh, I see, so maybe it's better to...
If you lodge it up there.
Here, okay.
When you get the handout, one side is a bibliography. Some, not absolutely all of the things that I will mention are there, a mixture of things, as you'll see as I go along. And then on another side, some terminology that sometimes people don't pick up as one is talking. So I'll try to indicate where something is actually on the page. And those are in three separate blocks. They're not, in fact, related, so they're just notes. So you catch the words. Well, thank you for that very warm welcome. It's very nice to be out, to be here. I can see a lot of friendly faces in the group, and there will, of course, be time for challenge and questions at the end. And it's an honour to start such a series. I shall probably be much more general than other people, and the reasons why will appear as I'm going through. Well, the terminology used in the description of this series expects, I think, of the speakers, the participants, that they declare and discuss their personal perspectives and engage in some way with the other or in reflection on their engagement with the other. The assumption seems to be in subsequent weeks that both the self and the other will be either a practicing Christian or a Hindu. If asked, and I don't want to designate others in ways with which they're not comfortable, later speakers might see themselves as theologians, which may or may not be a correct term for Hindus. That in itself is an interesting debate about self and other. And as practitioners of a faith, lay or clerical, again, not everybody's language. But people reflectively involved in the practicalities of interfaith dialogue, which can be seen as an outreach of more abstract theologies, which give dialogue theoretical justification or grounding, and in which the challenges resulting from dialogue may also produce changes. I want to begin by saying that I come to the subject under discussion and want to self-identify as a student, still very much a student of religion, since I've always chosen to work very broadly and haven't any hope before I die of feeling that I've even begun to understand the phenomena with which I engage. So I want to self-identify as a student of religion and religions, and do not assume that either the student, researcher, scholar, or teacher of religion has to have any religious affiliation as such to engage authentically in the task of gaining accurate knowledge and understanding of traditions, although, of course, he or she will have a cultural context. The broad field of the study of religions can and does include within it the study of individual confessional theologies, that isn't excluded, done by insiders, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Jewish, etc. Of worldviews, and this is where you've got some terms on the back of the sheet from the bibliography, of worldviews, Buddhist, alternative religious traditions, or of life ways, of the First Nation and African Indigenous peoples, for example. I'm moving between different terminologies there because in terms of self-identification, any one of them might not be appropriate for others. And it can, although less frequently does, include courses on interfaith dialogue as a type of theological or lifeway praxis. But as a multidisciplinary field, the study of religions also includes in its methods anthropologies, sociologies, psychologies, histories, phenomenologies, etc., etc. Don't want to leave anything out, but in fact the list is as pretty well goes on. None of these, including theologies, are monolithic, which is why I've used them all in the plural. All now take seriously, both for the researcher and the research, the language of self and other, which is our theme, or other appropriate terms, such as emic, the insider's language, and etic, the outsider's representation of that language, which attempts to match it with language used elsewhere. And of course, a book like the McCutcheon selection, which is on the bibliography in its introduction, interacts with this sort of terminology. Also takes seriously intertextuality or interspirituality. Many methods have reductionist and projectionist strands within them, which seek to explain away religious faith and activity as deriving from psychological or sociological forces, and this puts them at the other end of the spectrum from theologies as expression of belief, though of course both may also be seen as positions of assumption, as distinct from what has been called in the field methodological agnosticism. Part of the challenge of the complex postmodern world in which we live is its plurality. This is far more complex than the challenge for the Hindu of living next door to a Christian in a secular state, or to Christian theologians of the presence of the old and sophisticated Hindu philosophers of religion now on their bookshelves. There is also interior, the second block on your back of your sheet, interior plurality, by which I mean plurality within any individual's life, that is, being a Christian Marxist, an Irish Roman Catholic Hindu, a Jewish Buddhist, or having Nigerian Lifeway socialist grandchildren in London. That's now how the world is. An appropriate emphasis here is on the multiple cultural competences which many develop in negotiating the interior pluralities in their lives. There's also an awareness of internal plurality, what Panikkar calls, with reference to dialogue, the intra-faith diversity. Within single traditions, such as these we label Christian or Hindu, for instance, we have Vaishnava Hindus, Canadian Gujarati worshippers of the Mahadevi, Korean Protestants, African Anglicans, as well as liberals and fundamentalists in strands within each of these traditions. These are as important as the externally plural cultures in which we live, and figures for which are discussed in something like the Director of Religions in the United Kingdom, published from Derby. The plurality that's obvious there is the arena of the inter-religious in Panikkar's terms. In relationship to all these pluralities, it is more and more dangerous to make assumptions about the other whom we meet, and more important to develop the skills to discern the self-identity of a person or a group. So the Bengali Indian talking to the Christian visitor to India may be a Marxist, and the English woman from Devon meeting the Hindu visitor there to see Tagore's inheritance at Dartington Hall may be a Buddhist. The Gujarati that is my new neighbour in Birmingham is hurt when I assume in a welcoming, positive manner that she is a Hindu, when she is, in fact, like me, possibly her assumption, a Christian come to live in a Christian country. The very terms self and other that have become so dominant in our discussions may themselves now be too impermeable for the changing, moving, growing lives of both individuals and traditions. So let me begin again, begun already twice before, educationally, as in my title, with individual human persons. As I understand it, and I'm not an expert in child psychology, we mature, each at a slightly different speed and with some greater or lesser capacity, as we move from egotism, being rooted only in the boundaries of our own feelings, needs, and sensations, to awareness of others as separate and hurting beings, both mother, sister, and cat. It's when we understand that the cat hurts if I pull her tail, that my sister is upset if I will not play with her, that dramatic leaps in personal growth and education occur. This expanding of the boundaries of our awareness continues, ideally, in our formal as well as more informal social, intellectual, moral and political education. In history, for example, if we're well taught, we come to be able to recreate in our imagination what it would have been like to live as a Roman Catholic in Elizabethan England. Or, if world history is on the syllabus, we should be able to enter into the challenging experiences of a Punjabi Muslim, Hindu or Sikh in India at the time of partition. We become able to move across the historical, cultural and geographical boundaries that divide self and other. There are in these scenarios radical differences, but also a sense of the other as human being like oneself, even when unlike in so many ways. This is a key contribution of Enlightenment thinking, which I'm not happy to see abandoned with postmodern criticism. The text of a play like Lessing's Nathan the Wise has an emphasis that I do not want to discard, on, for instance, the question of whether Jews and Muslims, the faiths dealt with alongside Christianity in this play, are to be seen as men, Lessing's terminology, rather than Jews or Christians. There is here an emphasis on an underlying humanity with which we can all identify. So to summarise, I've so far introduced, I hope, various key ideas. The importance of an awareness of different kinds of diversity. The idea that all education extends the boundaries of our awareness from self to other, and by so doing develops the self into a fuller human being. That imagination has an important part to play in this process. In studying the Enlightenment, Lessing's play had more impact on me than Kant's seminal essay, What is Enlightenment?, which is reproduced in the McCutcheon book. So the student of religion who chooses to study either Hinduism or Christianity as a religious and cultural other system needs to develop the skills involved in the methodologically agnostic field of the study of religions or religious studies, whatever their own background. It's important for me to state, or perhaps recap or repeat at this point, that my paper's not going to be comparative religion or comparative lifeway analysis or comparative theological analysis, but an exploration with examples from my own journey of learning of how someone from a Western cultural background interested in and embarking on the study of religions might learn in particular about Hindu texts, culture and peoples. Much of what I'll say will be illustrated with the example of religious traditions other than Hindu. And there might also be, in this context, there might also be a place for radical challenges for learning about the otherness of various forms of Christianities too, whatever tradition is a person's self, their starting point. A quote from William Blake: opposition is true friendship, and without contraries, there is no progression. My first example has come to mean more to me as I've listened to those like Graham Harvey talk about their ethnographic research amongst members of indigenous religious traditions. This research focuses challenges the typologies that we use to organize material. Too simplistic is the designation of Hinduism as a world religion, an argument strongly made in the article by Timothy Fitzgerald listed in your bibliography. Much that is studied under the label Hindu is in fact the indigenous religion of India. But it's another point that I want to draw out of Harvey's work. He discusses what happens in the Maori ritual of Hakka in the space of the Marae. The Hakka ritual, or dance, may not be the appropriate terms, challenges the possible enemy who is approaching, identifies him or her as desiring to be and to be accepted as guest, and then makes them friend. Most of our encounters don't grow through such a ritual, and yet concepts and processes involved are important. For we can in our encounters be or stay as enemies in other and many ways. A recent example of Hindu reactions to the Freudian analysis of the stories of Ganesh's relationship with Shiva in Paul Courtright's book Ganesh is a vivid reminder of the scholar seen as enemy and not having gone through the process of becoming friend, at least to one particular group of Hindus in India. My first meeting with Hindus was providential in this way. My analysis of it is retrospective. The university where I was an undergraduate had a scheme where people across subjects and nationalities became friends. I met and visited the home of a Ugandan Asian reading law. She was married with two small boys, and it was always easier for her to meet at her home in the context of cooking and domestic life than on the university campus. The learning that I embarked upon revolved around food, family chat at the end of a school and working day, and a very warm and generous hospitality. She was the oldest of three sisters who, with their parents, all live nearby. The stories of the three sisters' marriage arrangements, one arranged or assisted successfully, the oldest and my friend, one unsuccessfully, the middle sister, and then the youngest daughter being allowed because of the parents' concern over their failure with the second sister to date and to bring home young men she was meeting as a student. All of them, as it happened, were of Southeast Asian or an Indian cultural background. I was shown how to wear a sari and given two as a gift. My friend also showed me the images on the mantelpiece of her bedroom, which served as the family shrine, and she talked to me in particular about Ganesh and her image of Shiva Nataraj, her chosen focus of worship, her Ishta Devata. My learning here was a seamless human and total cultural experience, indicating, without analysis at the time, what I later read about Hinduism, that it's not a religion seen as a belief system or a special activity, but a way of life. The family didn't go to any temple on a special day of the week, for example, to practice their Hinduism. Indeed, there was no Hindu temple in the area at the time. It was also a lesson in diaspora and cultural transplantation. The next stage in my education was much more bookish, though at first not conventionally so. I very much enjoyed the dialogical, conversational, interactive little book, World Religions, a Dialogue, by Ninian Smart. Since my interest at this time was very question-based, what do other people think about this, that, and the other, all the big questions of life that are, of course, unanswerable, and dialogue served this very well. I'd heard Ninian Smart lecture when I was still an undergraduate reading a very traditional theology degree. I'd heard him lecture at a study Swanwick and liked the mental agility with which he moved between worldviews as he talked on that occasion about the problem of evil and suffering, including asking whether there was such a problem posed in the standard Western terms of Christian philosophies of religion if one started from a Buddhist position without a belief in an all-powerful creator, good God. His little World Religions a Dialogue had brought interesting reactions from reviewers. Some said it was far too civilized, Irenic and reasonable to be a real dialogue, on the assumption that if you've got half a dozen people from different traditions together, they were bound to be nasty to each other and fight. Others criticized him for publishing under his own name, immorally, a set of conversations in which six or seven others were involved. How dare he not put the names of the other participants on the spine? It was, of course, neither of these things. It was entirely a work of his own imagination. I mention this book, long out of print and in many ways dated, because it demonstrates that the way of doing things of a scholar who has been in the United Kingdom, the main spokesperson for phenomenology of religion, indeed for religious studies in general, was seriously dialogical, or we might use conversational as a less loaded term. Dialogue is something which in Flood's critical study, listed on your bibliography, Beyond Phenomenology, is suggested as a better way of doing or approaching material than phenomenology. Yet my understanding and experience of phenomenological approaches, of which he is critical, is precisely, to quote his words of the better way of doing it, conversation with texts and persons, becoming part of an intersubjective and intertextual matrix in which all understanding and explanation arises, and that this makes for dialogical reflexivity. Subsequent upon this encounter with Smart's intellectual agility and dialogical explorations, I was able to study with him and others in Lancaster and both read about Hinduism and study Hindu texts. A predominant method across the department's courses and general ethos was rooted in phenomenology of religion. I shall say a bit more about that later. But there was also a strong affirmation of the need to be polymethodic, to cross in disciplines, and to be interdisciplinary in religious studies. In keeping with the emphasis in phenomenology on understanding religions from the point of view of those whose religions they are, perhaps that's the heart of what phenomenology is, not understanding a tradition from another point of view, but trying to become, through imaginative participation, as much of an insider as is humanly possible, with all the drawbacks of that. So to try and understand traditions as they are understood by believers or belongers, because believer is not necessarily the right term for everyone. So every attempt was made to include books by practicing Hindus themselves. That was actually easy. It's easier now to do that than it was then, because of my ancient years. The main academic input of a Hindu voice was Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, of course, a sporting professor here in Oxford. Particularly as an overview of Hinduism, his book The Hindu View of Life, in regular print since 1923. His books, of course, on Indian philosophy, and his commentary on the Principal Upanishads, an edition of the Brahma Sutra. In educational terms, this emphasis on the insider's views was excellent, but severely limited by what was available, and of course, by the Advaita Vedanta perspective of Radhakrishnan's presentation of Hinduism, which is certainly not the only Hindu view of life. His commentary on the Upanishads focused more on comparisons with Western idealist philosophy than on mining their multivocal interpretations within Hindu traditions. Although the phenomenological emphasis was on face-to-face meeting and listening to believer belongers, there was in fact no Hindu community in Lancaster at that time to give a more popular bhakti perspective, to name one possible balance to Radhakrishnan's views. The Bhagavad Gita itself was accessed through Edgerton's translation and later through R.C. Zainer's work. What was also missing, I think, was our present rigour in asking of texts the perspective of the authors and transmitters and the nature of the intended audience, including our concern for post-colonial and gender perspectives. To quote, understanding is always from a place, from a gendered location. This strength of that emphasis was yet to come. The most sophisticated insights into the influence of West on East, as far as Hinduism was concerned, was that produced, I think, in a reading of Farquhar's Modern Religious Movements in India, which, of course, is very old, delivered as lectures in the USA in 1913, and written up, in fact, in Frenchay Road in Oxford. It's a nice connection when I finally moved to Oxford to find that I was living in the road next door to Frenchay Road, where he'd done that in 1914. But also in the history of the subject, because Eric Sharp, whose book Comparative Religion, A History, which I'd prefer to be called The Study of Religions, A History, came out in 1975, updated in 1986, but Eric Sharp also taught in the Lancaster department. So that sense of the history of the subject, and of course there's nothing like looking at history to show that everything goes in phases. It's very, very educative in itself to see that we'll all be rubbished and dated in the decades that follow us by looking at what's happened in the past. As well as studying texts, I was also involved in more multifaceted ways of understanding, not only with an emphasis on Indian context, but also on the non-doctrinal dimensions of Hindu life, which included its social, ritual, and material dimensions. These came through a television series called The Long Search, which was produced in the mid-1970s. Since students and members of the general public cannot all go to India, even in these days of long-distance travel, or even visit a local Hindu community, this was a way of taking India to them. It was a practical exercise in the phenomenology of religion. Ninian Smart was the consultant to the series, but refused to be the expert being filmed or the introducer in front of the camera. Ronald Eyre, now deceased, was a self-styled Yorkshire-born theatre director whom the people he met assumed to be a Christian, but he never said he was one, with no formal qualifications in religious studies, was the front-up person. In the series, we live with his self-reflexivity. He explained in the first programme, which was the one on Hinduism, that authority was to lie with the people he would talk to, not with some outside expert. In the programme, the people whom one heard and saw varied greatly. For example, Shivish Thakur, the Indian philosopher, who at that time worked in Reading, later in the United States, took Ronald Eyre back to the Indian village in which he'd been born and grown up, and in his early education had taken place, and entered into the Hindu life of his community. So we had Shivish Thakur's reflexivity on his journey from east to west alongside Ronald Eyre's. Another participant, Dr. Sharma, took Ronald Eyre around his city and showed him a potter's yard full of fragments of clay images and talked about these images as educational toys and of the Hindus' choice of which deity to focus on in worship. We were present at a boys' school festival honouring Saraswati, the goddess of learning, at the end of which we saw a joyful procession placing the clay image, which had been specially made for the occasion and blessed, placing of it in a village pond, where the clay would return to its original state. Clay, we were told by the people in the community, is impermanent, though what it symbolises is not. At another girls' school, a Vaishnavite singer, distinguished by his forehead marking, sang songs to Shiva. One of the most valuable aspects of this programme, to my mind, and it was aimed at a Western Christian and post-Christian audience, was its exploration of two areas most perplexing to Christians, the seeming multiplicity of Hindu gods and the place of images. This, of course, raises the question of whether areas that were focused upon were an agenda in themselves, selected in advance for the Western audience. The influence of West on East was brought to my attention when, having heard Shivish Thakur say that there was obvious sexual reference and symbolism in the Lingam and Yoni, a young middle-class Indian woman guide said to the group I was with standing in a Hindu temple that she'd been brought up to see the Shiva Lingam as an abstract symbol indicating that God was beyond form. Two Hindus saying quite different things about a symbol in their tradition. Quite likely hers may have been a cultural response in terms of the background of her comment, a cultural response to Western missionary and colonial critique of Hindu icons, provides a good example of the differences in insiders' perspectives, which of course then need further reflection and analysis by the outsider. These two areas, the seeming multiplicity of Hindu gods and the place of use of images, are the most tenacious aspects of Hindu and Christian self and other understanding or misunderstanding in my educational experience. And it's an aspect that is most effectively accessed when the perspectives of Jewish and Muslim others are brought into play. The perplexed attempt by the Jewish and Muslim other to understand the Christian self-identification as monotheist and as a person who doesn't worship idols demands of the Christian explanations which place him or her much closer to Hindus than the records of their historical encounters might suggest or allow for. Such topics reveal how many selves and others there are within Christianity, the intra-religious plurality referred to earlier. The long search went out with accompanying books, one of which is on your bibliography, in the mid-70s, and about that time too, the Open University was producing video material to accompany its course called at that time Man's Religious Quest. The title was later changed to The Religious Quest, and in fact they've developed their courses in different directions since. The written material on village Hinduism prepared by Simon Waitman of SOAS, who also wrote the section on Hinduism in the Hinnor's Handbook of Living Religions, it was accompanied by 50 minutes of filming in an Indian village, which was very innovative and enabled in particular an exploration of the different levels and different orientations in which village Hindus live their life way. This anthropological analysis, which is paralleled in studies of Buddhism in the work, for instance, of Melford Spiro in Burma, look at the three levels of engagement as, and this is the last block of in the notes, as a transcendent orientation to do with the deed, the thought, the act, as to do with salvation, moksha. Again, the English word is not really a proper match to the Sanskrit, but it is actually what Simon Waitman uses. The social or dharmic orientation to do with merit making and your place as a good member of a society, and the pragmatic to do with your action in connection with good crops, illness, passing examinations, for instance. These are not, of course, mutually exclusive, either at any one time or in the whole lifetime of a person, or in the emphasis of the tradition as a whole. As well as this pioneering presentation of popular, as distinct from classical Hinduism, the written part of the course for the Open University also included analysis of philosophical schools and texts, so they did attempt to have a balance, which was relatively unusual at the time. Anthropological studies of India now abound, and other useful studies to complement Waitman's work, two things which again are on your bibliography, Pocock's Mind, Body and Wealth, published in 1973, and Fuller's The Camphor Flame from 1992. And the studies that have come from the Leeds Community Religions Project, nearer to home, in Kim Knott's Hinduism in Leeds, for example. Other studies have come from that project too. The examination of the multi-levelled nature of practices throws students back on self-analysis in respect of any other tradition with which they self-identify or are studying. One of the most interesting things to ask of this kind of analysis is, well, how's that sort of thing going on in one's local church? You know, why are people there? Is it for the nice social gathering and for the cup of coffee afterwards, the social support? Is it because they're actually praying for help through an illness? Is it because they hope for the kingdom of heaven? These things are, of course, in analysis of one tradition, they throw the student back onto that kind of self-awareness, that reflexively, well, you know, does this actually apply also to the one that is my own? Self-awareness and reflexivity and engagement with the others is vividly present in the writings of some scholars, if not in all their works, at least in some of them. And I found very useful over the years the chapter called Theology at 120 degrees Fahrenheit in Klaus Klostermeyer's Hindu and Christian in Vrindavan. Klaus Klostermeyer was the very first director of the Hindu Studies Centre here in Oxford, so many of you will have met him. Here, Klostermeyer reflects on the challenge to his thinking of the context of a Hindu village in which he, then a young Roman Catholic priest, is living. The theologian at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, with roast chicken and a glass of good wine, like it is in Oxford every day, the theologian with a glass of good wine and roast chicken imagines God as happy and contented, well-fed and rested. Perhaps. Whereas the theologian at 120 degrees Fahrenheit, watching and hearing a goat die of sunstroke round which the vultures wait, drinking water from a well in which someone fell and died a few months ago, and with sugar on the table in which ants are scurrying, has a different view of the god or goddess from whose countenance issues life, but death from her back. Who is different, the theos or the theologian? Another good self-reflective text, also listed on your bibliography, of course, is Diana Eck's book, Encountering God. So far, I've discussed and mentioned how filmed material can enable us to enter into another's world and how autobiographical writing can be a bridge to understanding. Imaginative literature, fiction, novels, autobiography can give us considerable insights into the lives of others. I want to mention just one from the long list that can be drawn up of novels in English that focus on India and are now arising in the diaspora. I don't know any of you have also been listening. It's the book of the week on Radio 4 to the book My Life in Orange, which is being read, which is a child of the Rajneesh movement. I have found that giving a list of novels to undergraduates to read alongside academic studies can be very enriching. Here I shall mention just one, Heather Wood's Third Class Ticket. Heather Wood went to India to do her doctoral research in social anthropology. An encounter she had with a group of villagers whose head woman had left monies for them to travel round India to learn about their democracy inspired an anthropological, parallel to an historical, novel. This was reviewed by Richard Gombrich in the Oxford University India Society's journal when the book was first published in 1980. The review begins by reflecting on the nature of anthropology, one of the contributing disciplines to the field of religious studies, and why people do it. Gombrich's words, "Many take up the subject because of their curiosity about human beings and their relationships." That's why I read theology in the first place, a bit disappointingly, but the religious studies bit hasn't ever been disappointing. "Many take up a subject because of their curiosity about human beings and their relationships, a wish to learn how people differently circumstanced differ from us and to what extent they're still like us, an urge to extend the limits of their imaginative experience, who aspire above all to empathise and sympathise." The review continues in describing how much this anthropological novel contributes to such understanding. That the purpose and effect of novels overlaps the more formal methodological processes in the study of religions is well explored by Chris Arthur in his article, also listed on your bibliography, Phenomenology of Religion and the Art of Storytelling, in which he explores the relevance of William Golding's great novel, The Inheritors, to religious studies. He seeks to demonstrate from a piece of imaginative writing how religions might be studied in a way which is in accordance with at least one understanding of phenomenological approaches to the study of religions. Arthur notes the sense of being worlds apart from the people with whom we're otherwise standing shoulder to shoulder. So the challenge is to pass over into a religious situation which one wants to investigate and come back to report it. He then concentrates on the disciplined use of imagination. One could add the phrase sympathetic imagination, which is commonly used by Ninian Smart, penetrative imaginative sympathy, sympathy, which is a phrase in the translation of Rudolf Otto, inferring what goes on in another mind and heart, which is Cantwell Smith, which enables the open-mindedness, suspending of value judgment, and becoming an actor in the participant role. The participant is imaginatively re-experiencing. Both anthropological and sociological approaches involve what is usually called participant observation, and in this one deliberately allows the boundaries between oneself as, say, a practicing Christian to be permeable as one takes off one's shoes and is fully present at puja and then eats with one's hostess. I've known Christian students who are not prepared to take off their shoes when entering a Hindu temple, as this to them seems a first step to worship in an environment which to them is wrong. They do not find participant observation a possible personal option. So not everyone is prepared to make this kind of educational journey, and these students I've found some of my greatest educational challenges, because there's a closed door. They won't begin that particular journey. I've mentioned phenomenology of religion many times already and want now to round off the formal part of my input so that we can have some discussion by bringing these references together and exploring phenomenological approaches as sound bases for education in religions, for becoming religiate as a term parallel to becoming literate or numerate. It sounds a clumsy word, because only because we're not so used to using it. We talk easily about people becoming numerate and literate. Well, here's an idea of how we might become religiate. Not at all the same as being religious, notice. While doing this, I wish to emphasise that the varied methods used for the study of religions, which will enable any student, any human being, to enter into the thought world of another, including a Hindu exploring the life way of another Hindu, and a Christian, the alternative worldview of another Christian. They can be just as big in leaps as are going from one whole religion into understanding another. And these are not completely separate. Methods and material overlap. Scholars embark on the sociology of sacred texts, the history of iconography, visual anthropology, and historical and social anthropology. These are all part of the developing scene. Many of the accumulation of conventions, and that's the way I prefer to talk about it rather than talking about a rigorous methodology, many of the accumulation of conventions that make up phenomenological approaches to the study of religions have already been mentioned, but I'll give here a full list. It's taken from work done recently by John Shepherd in Lancaster, who was the first registered research student in the new Lancaster Department of Religious Studies in 1967, and someone who wishes to affirm in his recent research and writing the multi-perspectival and critical dimension of phenomenology of religion as he understands it. His most recent paper was at a conference called Religious Studies, What's the Point? In Lancaster in December of last year. He lists the characteristics of phenomenology of religion, which I've suggested above is an accumulation of conventions, as follows. First, the academic study of religions is about promoting understanding of a faith, but not about promoting a faith. This he calls description, not evaluation. The aim is to gain an understanding of a faith, not to account for its existence. In particular, any kind of reductionism is to be eschewed. This he calls description, not explanation. Phenomenological description needs to transcend the informative by conveying the flavour of personal experiencing, believing, participating, etc. This he calls objective description of the subjective. Fourth, the academic student of religions' own beliefs, attitudes, values, etc., should be temporarily suspended in order to avoid contaminating one's description with personal prejudice, bias, or one's own personal religious or philosophical commitments. This is the epoche, or bracketing, of which phenomenologists speak, terminology, of course, taken from Husserl. Following from the act of bracketing is what has come to be called methodological agnosticism. Six, one should enter into another person's position as far as one possibly can. This is where the saying, never judge a person until you've walked a mile in their moccasins, comes into play, and the term empathy or sympathetic imagination is used. Last, the phenomenon should be described in its own terms. So referring to Muslims as Mohammedans, or the Jewish scriptures as the Old Testament, or the heart of Hinduism as belief in, should be sensitively seen as not appropriate. It's never been envisaged by those of us who see this set of conventions as providing a just and sound set. I think justice, for me, is very important in doing things this way. In providing a just and sound set of educational tools, that the study of religions is a single discipline, but rather necessarily a multidisciplinary field, and that others approach the material with some of these skills and emphases, so that it's never been envisaged that what's going on is a single rigorous discipline, but rather an accumulation of conventions which actually overlap quite a lot of other approaches and methodologies. It's been said, for instance, that anthropologists do very well what phenomenologists think they do, which I think is probably quite accurate. And I acknowledged earlier in my paper that the skills involved in the participant-observer approaches are used extensively by both sociologists and anthropologists. Many disciplines, as well as the plurality within traditions to which we give these monolithic labels, such as Hinduism, lie alongside each other and produce a natural multitude of perspectives. They also introduce challenges to insider understandings, which both the scholar and the believer belonger need to engage. And here I'm going to quote two examples, which happen to be ones about Hinduism, used by John Shepherd. Hindus venerate the cow, yet as Cantwell Smith has observed, the Hindu does not reverence the cow we see, but the cow he sees. According to the phenomenological approach, empathy, bracketing, etc., are needed as a means of getting the feel of this. However, it would be arbitrary to feel obliged to stop there. For consider, suppose for the sake of argument that in due course some such explanation of the Hindu veneration of the cow, as is provided by Marvin Harris's cultural materialism, should turn out to be true. It would then be perverse to insist that, in religious studies at least, veneration of the cow should continue to be understood in terms of empathetic identification with a person such as Gandhi alone. We don't want an understanding of religion that precludes an understanding of any truth about religion. Or, take Sati, is his other example. A restrictive phenomenological account will emphasise, say, the qualities of nobility and auspiciousness embodied in the practice. A more open-ended phenomenological approach will see this as but part of a more composite picture. Academic students of religion also want to know why there has been a certain revival of sati in recent times. Why? That's not explained entirely from the insider's emphasis. An initially plausible explanation links it to a protest of Rajputs and related groups against their loss of status in recent Rajasthan. Whatever the merits of the details of the explanation to which I'm referring, any understanding of contemporary sati which was restricted to nobility and auspiciousness at the expense of the socio-economic context in which the practice is embedded, would be conspicuously incomplete. It would be tantamount to a romanticized distortion. What phenomenology has put foremost on the agenda are the skills needed to move about between perspectives, initially from those of outsiders to those of insiders in religious traditions, and to try to check that one has got a proper picture in those terms. However, as previously quoted examples have shown, insiders vary, disagree, are sometimes wrong about facts. And this extends one's education in diversity and the refinement in using one's skills of understandings. There are also the different views and explorations of those outside which are different from one's own and which demand consideration. The same skills and even the same language of outsider, insider come into play in all these examples. All involve the development of discernment, which continuously challenges and enlarges our growth as human persons and world citizens, wherever and whenever we begin. That seems to me to be what I mean by education, and it's an ideal process worth pursuing, both by oneself and in interaction with others.
Thank you very much indeed. I think I'm sure there'll be a number of responses that we'll want to make. We always do recognise, however, that there are some who come for a lecture and have other things to do, so if you need to leave at this point, then please feel free to do that with no embarrassment at all. But we do hope that many of you are able to stay about a quarter an hour for questions and discussions if you're able to do that while two are making their exit. So it's an interesting sense of how things come full circle very often. I was introduced to the study of Indian religious traditions many years ago in Manchester by Trevor Ling, who was then professor of what was then called comparative religion. When I arrived here for graduate study in the mid-1980s, I discovered that he'd been a student here at Regent's Park College just after the Second World War, so there are all sorts of resonances in the way that you've told the story, which I'm sure others of us would have identified with parts of how our story has worked, even if the individuals may have played a part. Questions and comments, yes, start over there, thank you.
My question about the phenomenological approach is, do you think there's a problem that it overlooks or attempts to eradicate difference in its search for bridges between cultures?
Well, just a very simple answer, no. I think it actually makes one very aware of differences, but it depends what kind of differences you're thinking of.
I suppose what I'm thinking about is that the empathetic approach would encourage one to think of oneself and the other person as the same, and one's views and beliefs, worldview as the same. And I just, that seems misleading to me.
I don't like the term comparative religion. I did mention Eric Sharp's book, and that is the title of the book, and I also said I would prefer it to be called The Study of Religion as a History, because I don't deliberately set out to be comparative ever, although it does, you know, sometimes happen, but it's not my original intention. And that, I mean, it is some people's, and I don't want to challenge that, but that's not where I'm coming from, as it were, in wanting to do that. Because I think that one needs to look at traditions, as it were, in their own terms, in the round. Of course, part of that is finding that the edges aren't neatly bounded, you know, that there are interreactions historically and geographically in terms of how people live. And a lot of people working in South Asian studies prefer not to use the terminology of whether you're a Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, because, you know, actually what's going on, for instance, in particular shrines, involves everybody in a way where they don't want to self-identify as separate. So I'm very aware of the difficulties of what we're trying to do. But I think that, one of the first things that is often listed in the phenomenologic enterprise is the bracketing of value judgments. But there has to be tremendous self-awareness in order to know what value judgments you have, an awareness of self, and what value judgments you have. And it's always a dialogical process, because you think what you're doing is unclouded, you're going as open with spirit, and then you suddenly find something whams you in the face and actually you haven't at all. So that's where the sort of conversational element is bound to be part of it. But I do want to stand on the common humanity on one level of the enlightenment perception, albeit people see that as a very troubled perception now. So I think there is a common humanity between us that, if I go into an Indian village which is totally other with a gun and shoot somebody, I've done something to a fellow human. I think there are things there which need to be maintained despite the radical cultural differences. But one finds those radical cultural differences within any single tradition. So the assumption that somehow if I'm working within the arena of Christianity, I don't have those same challenges that I have if I'm working in the arena of a Hindu community. I think there are the same range of challenges about the assumptions I come with, whether I know what they are, whether I have set them aside, how open I am, where value judgments intrude. It isn't that one makes a step, has sort of changed oneself or opened oneself and does something and that's all nice. It isn't tidy at all. That's why words like conversational or dialogical are the best ones, because it's a constant coming and going, changing, adjusting, being questioned, challenged, and it works both ways, I think. And I think when people want to know whether also it's possible, which may be part of your question, whether anything is possible in a perfect way, of course, I would hesitate to assert. But it seems to me that what I'm trying to set out is an educational goal which is worth moving towards. It's the worthwhileness to me of doing things this way that is important, not that I think that some perfect method or accumulation of conventions is sort of attainable within a year of academic study.
Yes.
I'm very new to this, so this may be a question of betraying too much ignorance, but on everything that you've said, I get the impression that most of the work is being done within this country or the Western tradition, and I was wondering whether within the Hindu tradition there are people trying to look towards Christian experience and do something similar to what you described.
There are no religious studies departments in the state universities, for instance, in India, so on one level that's not happening, but amongst Indian peoples in India, I think it is. But there are people here who are much better qualified. Where's Frank? To answer a question like that, Nima, yes, you're much better qualified to answer that question.
About the teaching of religion in India?
Well, yes. Or learning from Christianity. Learning about Christianity.
This is Professor Neil Chittipaker from Delhi.
Well, we don't really have religious studies in universities at all. And if at all it's studied by students of history or students of philosophy. So they approach religion through their disciplines. So there are certain institutes where you have studying Christianity, like we have the Digital Institute in Delhi. But I don't really know of very active ones in Hinduism itself. It's almost like it's taken for granted that if you are a Hindu, you're living it, you're understanding it, you've been becoming it. There's no real need to understand it as, to study it the way it's done in countries in the West. And I almost feel I've been feeling more and more lately that it's something that's been hijacked, it's been taken away from us. So such wonderful books have been written, and with so much of detail, and by people from outside. Those who have written in India, they're good, but they're not recognized globally so much. It's almost as if they wrote mainly for the Indian audience. But the books that are being recognized and those that are being read fast, those are mainly by scholars in the West. And I think Indians are uncomfortable also at Hungary to talk about Hinduism, to write about Hinduism. It's almost as if it's something that's just very personal and needs to stay inside and doesn't need to be talked about. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Well, that's a very interesting answer.
An answer that's part of the challenge, you see.
Yes.
Peggy, thank you very much for your talk. I enjoyed it very much. I'd like to ask you whether you think, and whether phenomenologists, those who follow phenomenology, think, that the researcher, him or herself, must be prepared to change in the process. I noted how actually it was the idea in phenomenology that actually understanding may not require personal engagement, and that only comes at the stage of evaluation. But there are others, something of Professor Robert Jackson in Warwick, who tends to say that even at the level of understanding, there is our personality, if you like, and our values somehow have an influence on that cognition. I'd like to ask you what your opinion on that is.
There are two things you mentioned. My personal values having an influence on my understanding, but then in fact whether I am changed by what I do. Mm-hmm. Certainly the latter. In any educational process you're bound to be changed by enriched, I would say, within this field by what you're involved in, but would always make an effort not to let my own understandings be the filter, but let the presentation of the material be what speaks in any writing or teaching that I might do about a group, a tradition, a person, or whatever. So, but I think one is bound to be changed a great deal by whatever one undertakes to be doing as a student of a subject.
And is it important to be prepared to change?
Yes, I often quote Newman to people, you know, to grow is to change and to become perfect is to change often. It's not something to be afraid of, but it is true that many people who feel, think, have been told all of those things, that somehow they've arrived at a position of truth, are wary, even afraid, that this journey of exploration will change them. I mean, thinking of the practicalities of teaching undergraduates, my response to that, if somebody want to talk to me about it, would be that life will change you, the challenges of life will change you, you know, the betrayals of love, the death of people, your own severe illness, all of the things that will happen in life, as well as all the very positive things, will change you. That is not something you can avoid if you're fully alive, and that the arena of living with plurality in religions, whether it's the plurality of diversity within the faith you belong to, or whether it's the plurality of there being many religious positions, is one part of being alive. It is that the plurality is a fact of the world. And you know, I mean, I think in point of view of these things being explored in an undergraduate environment, you are in an environment where you've got, you know, a community for discussion and for helping to sort through the very big challenges and questions that come with looking at material in this way.
We have one here. Keith and then
last week, I went to a very powerful play, Taking Sides. I don't know if you saw that. It was about Furtwängler, the conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic, who did not leave Germany during the Nazi regime and was honoured by the regime and went through a denazification process at the end. And it's one of a number of papers that come out recently about what would the attitude be? Do you have to take sides? And it occurs to me also that in schools in Britain today, the most, in fact, almost the only historical subject people do is Hitler. And this does raise the question, what are you going to do about movements like that? And I'd just like you to say, what would a phenomenologist do about the National Socialists?
Well, that's something to understand in history, and certainly I think this kind of approach can be applied to historical situations. If one understood, if we think about one figure, but actually we're really thinking about a whole society, aren't we? If we are able to understand that figure, that society, in its own terms, it might enable us better to make sure that that road is not gone down again, which would be part of the reason why Holocaust studies is so dominant on our school syllabuses now, I'm sure.
You're not asking for sympathetic identification.
Well, that's what I would say is involved in the exercise of trying to understand what went into that situation, the why and the how. If you had, making the imaginative leap, which I'm sure a play like that, you know, imaginative literature does enable you to do that. We're very often just reading the facts in textbooks, seemingly objective historical textbooks can't. You can place yourself there and then as far as is possible, and that might mean that you know where decisions are, where the dangers in a human context are in a society, in the use of a vote, you know, whatever.
I'm not suggesting this has anything to do with Hinduism, but it's just
yes. But you obviously have doubts about whether it is useful to be able to do that, to imagine.
Okay, I think there are some Christians and there are some Hindus with whom I would not want to sympathetically identify.
You want to understand, to put it in very crude language, why they are like they are.
Yes, I would.
You do, the same as you do with the murderer in the prison. And you do, as a human being, want to understand why people are like they are. And it's not all bad, but you're just bringing. Well, but that that's to misunderstand what that term is, and you know that very well. You're being deliberately naughty. That's what philosophers of religion are like, quite rightly. But you know, it doesn't mean to be to act as that person, but to understand, as it were, the inside of that situation or person. So one isn't advocating.
Yeah, I'm all for phenomenology. I just think there is a big problem about bracketing your evaluation.
But the examples that I've given, these sort of open-endedness, is that the ideal is that you're trying first of all to understand the situation, the person, the religion, whatever we're talking about, as far as you possibly can as an insider. We're not talking about acting, we're talking about understanding the situation as far as possible as an insider. But then there is also, because the study of religions is seen to be interdisciplinary, that you will also take on board, as in those examples from Shepherd's writing, other questions and factors, and you will be to engage. So you would talk to the Hindu other about those issues that have been brought up, about, you know, the economic, social situation, which will actually have been a factor in all of this, and which they haven't mentioned so far, but which you're informed may. So again, we're going back to being dialogical. But, you know, the first step, which seems to me, as I've mentioned, a step of justice, is actually to try to see where the other person's coming from. Nobody ever suggests that that involves acting as that person. It's an intellectual exercise, not a deeds exercise.
Two more quick questions, I think, we've got queuing up, then I think we'll have to draw things to a close. Ken, first of all.
In your bibliography, you mentioned Gavin Wood's Beyond Phenomenology, and then in parentheses, you have Criticism of Phenomenology as Understood by Flood. Certainly this could be a whole paper in itself, which perhaps Gavin Flood would have to respond to, but if you can say something very
well. His Beyond advocates that there is more that is needed of intertextuality, conversation, the dialogical connection. He's got a list in the final part of the book about, you know, where he thinks religious studies might go. And none of the people, let's say one person whose book is down there, James Cox, who teaches at Edinburgh and who's a former colleague of mine, none of the people I know who would self-identify as phenomenologists of religion think that he's really got the whole picture of what they are doing. And I put James Cox's book down there rather than something by Eliade or some of the people that are the classic writers in phenomenology, because I think it's the only book I know which actually tries to talk you through how you might do it. He does this in the context of Zimbabwe, which was his research field. Of course, tragically, he hasn't been able to go back there for some time now. But most of us would say that the things that Gavin Flood are advocating, and I quoted some of the things he says, are precisely what phenomenologists have done and are trying to do. I mean, he's never said that he operates in that way, Gavin, and it seems to me he's not really completely understood, perhaps. Well, that's not the right thing to say, because he's a very fine scholar, but he's not seen the breadth, I think, understood the breadth, got inside the breadth of the work that phenomenologists have done. So most people I know who would self-identify as phenomenologists of religion don't think he's got it right.
Last question for this evening.
You said there has been a revival of study practices. I just wonder if you'd like to elaborate very briefly on that.
Yes, here I would be, that was a quotation I was using, but here I would be dependent entirely on the work that Julia Leslie has done, for instance. There have been recent, although of course it's illegal within the state of India, and again, Nilima probably knows more about this than I do, but there have been examples of suti recently, and of course a very important question is why. This is in very remote districts which are very difficult to police, where temples of course have been built to the woman who becomes a goddess on having gone through this, and then they become great pilgrimage centres. I say that just as a description of fact, but the questions that were brought up are there other factors in this happening apart from the very idealistic one of the woman herself wishing to go through this ceremony? So there has to be a conversation about that between the ethnographer and the community. But there are questions raised. Lima, would you like to comment?
No, it's just that it has been said that suddenly increased war after the British tried to ban it.
Mm-hmm.
That has also been said, that's been theoretically, people have written about that recently. And also just besides the idealistic reason, so often the economic reason is put forward, that the widow in any case has such a poor position in the family, economically as well as ideologically, that it would be far better for her to die, and she also believes in that. Besides the fact that she knows that she's going to be divinized after she dies, she's going to be deified. And sometimes it's forced upon her, and that's what, recently that's what we found, that members of the family themselves, for property reasons and economic reasons, force it upon her. But as Betty was saying, it happens only in very, very remote areas, policing is difficult, and the remote areas are multi-village, let's say, right in the interiors of the country. And it's something that feminist scholars are writing about. Why does it happen? Why are women, willing to do it? It's so complex. There's so many factors that go into it.
So every description is multi-layered,
that's right,
really, and will involve many Hindus in the comments as well as others.
And feminist scholars cannot go there, westernized feminist scholars cannot go to them and say, stop it, because that alienates all of those women. But how do you know what our needs are? So it's very difficult, tricky situation.
I think we must draw things to a conclusion for this evening, but we have got another 5 weeks in which some of these issues will continue to be explored, and I think we can already see the range of issues that might well crop up for us. Some of you will know that I spent the first 10 years of my career teaching religious studies in schools, and after teaching one module on Judaism, we had a young lady who came from a secular Jewish family who was so inspired by the module that she and her family started to practice again. Now, as an educationalist, I was posed whether this was a success or a failure. Whatever the outcome of that might be, I think, Peggy, both tonight and for many years, you've helped many of us to become more religiously literate, and for that we're very grateful. Thank you very much indeed. There are details of the programme at the back if you haven't already got it, and there are a mailing list for those who might like to sign up. Thank you.
I've got a lovely story from when Clive Lawton was a schoolboy and was actually born.